I made bread from both the einkorn and conventional flour, using only water and yeast, with no added sugars or flavorings. The einkorn flour looked much like conventional whole wheat flour, but once water and yeast were added, differences became evident. The light brown dough was less stretchy, less pliable, and stickier than a traditional dough, and lacked the moldability of conventional wheat flour dough. The dough smelled different, too, more like peanut butter, rather than the standard neutral smell of dough. It rose less than modern dough, rising just a little, compared to the doubling in size expected of modern bread. And, as Eli Rogosa claimed, the final bread product did indeed taste different, heavier, nutty, with an astringent aftertaste. I could envision this loaf of crude einkorn bread on the tables of 3rd century B.C. Amorites or Mesopotamians. I have a wheat sensitivity, so, in the interest of science, I conducted my own little experiment. 4 ounces of einkorn bread on day one versus 4 ounces of modern organic whole wheat bread on day two. I braced myself for the worst, since in the past my reactions have been rather unpleasant. Beyond simply observing my physical reaction, I also performed fingerstick blood sugars after eating each type of bread. The differences were striking. Blood sugar at the start, 84 milligrams per deciliter. Blood sugar after consuming einkorn bread, 110 milligrams per deciliter. This was more or less the expected response to eating some carbohydrate. Afterwards, though, I felt no perceptible effects, no sleepiness, no nausea, nothing hurt. In short, I felt fine. Whew! The next day, I repeated the procedure, substituting 4 ounces of conventional organic whole wheat bread. Blood sugar at the start, 84 milligrams per deciliter. Blood sugar after consuming conventional bread, 167 milligrams per deciliter. Moreover, I soon became nauseated, nearly losing my lunch. The queasy effect persisted for 36 hours, accompanied by stomach cramps that started almost immediately and lasted for many hours. Sleep that night was fitful, though filled with vivid dreams. I couldn't think straight, nor could I understand the research papers I was trying to read the next morning, having to read and reread paragraphs 4 or 5 times. I finally gave up. Only a full day and a half later did I start feeling normal again. I survived my little wheat experiment, but I was impressed with the difference in responses to the ancient wheat and the modern wheat in my whole wheat bread. Surely something odd was going on here. My personal experience, of course, does not qualify as a clinical trial, but it raises some questions about the potential differences that span a distance of 10,000 years, ancient wheat that predates the changes introduced by human genetic intervention versus modern wheat. Chapter 3. Wheat Deconstructed. Whether it's a loaf of organic high-fiber multigrain bread or a Twinkie, what exactly are you eating? We all know that the Twinkie is just a processed indulgence, but conventional advice tells us that the former is a better health choice, a source of fiber and B vitamins, and rich in complex carbohydrates. Ah, but there's always another layer to the story. Let's peer inside the contents of this grain and try to understand why, regardless of shape, color, fiber content, organic or not, it potentially does odd things to humans. Wheat, supercarbohydrate. The transformation of the domesticated wild grass of Neolithic times into the modern Cinnabon, French crullers, or Dunkin' Donuts requires some serious sleight of hand. These modern configurations were not possible with a dough of ancient wheat. An attempt to make a modern jelly donut with einkorn wheat, for example, would yield a crumbly mess that would not hold its filling, and it would taste, feel, and look like, well, a crumbly mess. In addition to hybridizing wheat for increased yield, plant geneticists have also sought to generate hybrids that have properties best suited to become, for instance, a chocolate sour cream cupcake or a 7-tiered wedding cake. Modern Triticum aestivum wheat flour is, on average, 70% carbohydrate by weight, with protein and indigestible fiber each comprising 10 to 15%. The small remaining weight of Triticum wheat flour is fat, mostly phospholipids and polyunsaturated fatty acids. Interestingly, ancient wheat has higher protein content. Emmer wheat, for instance, contains 28% or more protein. Wheat starches are the complex carbohydrates that are the darlings of dietitians. Complex means that the carbohydrates in wheat are composed of polymers, repeating chains, of the simple sugar, glucose, unlike simple carbohydrates such as sucrose, which are one or two unit sugar structures. Sucrose is a two sugar molecule, glucose and fructose. Conventional wisdom, such as that from your dietitian or the USDA, says we should all reduce our consumption of simple carbohydrates in the form of candy and soft drinks, and increase our consumption of complex carbohydrates. Of the complex carbohydrate in wheat, 75% is the chain of branching glucose units, amylopectin, and 25% is the linear chain of glucose units, amylose. In the human gastrointestinal tract, both amylopectin and amylose are digested by the salivary and stomach enzyme amylase. Amylopectin is efficiently digested by amylase to glucose, while amylose is much less efficiently digested, some of it making its way to the colon undigested. Thus, the complex carbohydrate amylopectin is rapidly converted to glucose and absorbed into the bloodstream, and because it is most efficiently digested, is mainly responsible for wheat's blood sugar increasing effect. Other carbohydrate foods also contain amylopectin, but not the same kind of amylopectin as wheat. The branching structure of amylopectin varies depending on its source. Amylopectin from legumes, so-called amylopectin C, is the least digestible. Hence the school kids chant, "Beans, beans, they're good for your heart. The more you eat them, the more you..." Undigested amylopectin makes its way to the colon, whereupon the symbiotic bacteria happily dwelling there feast on the undigested starches and generate gases such as nitrogen and hydrogen, making the sugars unavailable for you to digest. Amylopectin B is the form found in bananas and potatoes, and while more digestible than bean amylopectin C, still resists digestion to some degree. The most digestible form of amylopectin, amylopectin A, is the form found in wheat. Because it is the most digestible, it is the form that most enthusiastically increases blood sugar. This explains why, gram for gram, wheat increases blood sugar to a greater degree than, say, kidney beans or potato chips. The amylopectin A of wheat products, complex or no, might be regarded as a supercarbohydrate, a form of highly digestible carbohydrate that is more efficiently converted to blood sugar than nearly all other carbohydrate foods, simple or complex. This means that not all complex carbohydrates are created equal, with amylopectin A containing wheat increasing blood sugar more than other complex carbohydrates. But the uniquely digestible amylopectin A of wheat also means that the complex carbohydrate of wheat products, on a gram-for-gram basis, are no better and are often worse than even simple carbohydrates such as sucrose. People are usually shocked when I tell them that whole wheat bread increases blood sugar to a higher level than sucrose. Aside from some extra fiber, eating two slices of whole wheat bread is really little different, and often worse, than drinking a can of sugar-sweetened soda or eating a sugary candy bar. This information is not new. A 1981 University of Toronto study launched the concept of the glycemic index, that is, the comparative blood sugar effects of carbohydrates. The higher the blood sugar after consuming a specific food compared to glucose, the higher the glycemic index, GI. The original study showed that the GI of white bread was 69, while the GI of whole grain bread was 72, and shredded wheat cereal was 67, while that of sucrose, table sugar, was 59. Yes, the GI of whole grain bread is higher than that of sucrose. Incidentally, the GI of a Mars bar, nougat, chocolate, sugar, caramel, and all, is 68. That's better than whole grain bread. The GI of a Snickers bar is 41, far better than whole grain bread. In fact, the degree of processing, from a blood sugar standpoint, makes little difference. Wheat is wheat, with various forms of processing or lack of processing, simple or complex, high fiber or low fiber, all generating similarly high blood sugars. Just as boys will be boys, amylopectin A will be amylopectin A. In healthy, slender volunteers, two medium-sized slices of whole wheat bread increase blood sugar by 30 milligrams per deciliter, from 93 to 123 milligrams per deciliter, no different from white bread. In people with diabetes, both white and whole grain bread increase blood sugar to 70 to 120 milligrams per deciliter over starting levels. One consistent observation, also made in the original University of Toronto study, as well as in subsequent efforts, is that pasta has a lower 2-hour GI, with whole wheat spaghetti showing a GI of 42, compared to white flour spaghetti's GI of 50. Pasta stands apart from other wheat products, likely due in part to the compression of the wheat flour that occurs during the extruding process, slowing digestion by amylase. Rolled fresh pasta, such as fettuccine, has similar glycemic properties to extruded pastas. Pastas are also usually made from Triticum durum rather than Aestivum, putting them genetically closer to emmer. But even the favorable GI rating of pasta is misleading, since it is only a 2-hour observation, and pasta has the curious ability to generate high blood sugars for periods of 4 to 6 hours after consumption, sending blood sugars up by 100 milligrams per deciliter for sustained periods in people with diabetes. These irksome facts have not been lost on agricultural and food scientists, who have been trying, via genetic manipulation, to increase the content of so-called resistant starch, starch that does not get fully digested, and reduce the amount of amylopectin. Amylose is the most common resistant starch, comprising as much as 40 to 70% by weight in some purposefully hybridized varieties of wheat. Therefore, wheat products elevate blood sugar levels more than virtually any other carbohydrate, from beans to candy bars. This has important implications for body weight, since glucose is unavoidably accompanied by insulin, the hormone that allows entry of glucose into the cells of the body, converting the glucose to fat. The higher the blood glucose after consumption of food, the greater the insulin level, the more fat is deposited. This is why, say, eating a 3-egg omelet that triggers no increase in glucose does not add to body fat, while 2 slices of whole wheat bread increases blood glucose to high levels, triggering insulin and growth of fat, particularly abdominal or deep visceral fat. There's even more to wheat's curious glucose behavior. The amylopectin A-induced surge in glucose and insulin following wheat consumption is a 120-minute-long phenomenon that produces the high at the glucose peak, followed by the low of the inevitable glucose drop. The surge and drop creates a 2-hour roller coaster ride of satiety and hunger that repeats itself throughout the day. The glucose low is responsible for stomach growling at 9 a.m., just 2 hours after a bowl of wheat cereal or an English muffin breakfast, followed by 11 a.m. pre-lunch cravings, as well as the mental fog, fatigue, and shakiness of the hypoglycemic glucose nadir. Trigger high blood sugars repeatedly and/or over sustained periods, and more fat accumulation results. The consequences of glucose-insulin fat deposition are especially visible in the abdomen, resulting in, yes, wheat belly. The bigger your wheat belly, the poorer your response to insulin, since the deep visceral fat of the wheat belly is associated with poor responsiveness, or resistance to insulin, demanding higher and higher insulin levels, a situation that cultivates diabetes. Moreover, the bigger the wheat belly in males, the more estrogen is produced by fat tissue, and the larger the breasts. The bigger your wheat belly, the more inflammatory responses that are triggered, heart disease and cancer. Because of wheat's morphine-like effect, discussed in the next chapter, and the glucose-insulin cycle that wheat amylopectin A generates, wheat is, in effect, an appetite stimulant. Accordingly, people who eliminate wheat from their diet consume fewer calories, something I will discuss later in the book. If glucose-insulin fat provocation from wheat consumption is a major phenomenon underlying weight gain, then elimination of wheat from the diet should reverse the phenomenon. And that is exactly what happens. For years, wheat-related weight loss has been observed in patients with celiac disease, who must eliminate all foods containing gluten from their diets to halt an immune response gone awry, which in celiac patients essentially destroys the small intestine. As it happens, wheat-free, gluten-free diets are also amylopectin A-free. However, the weight loss effects of wheat elimination are not immediately clear from clinical studies. Many celiac sufferers are diagnosed after years of suffering and begin the diet change in a severely malnourished state due to prolonged diarrhea and impaired nutrient absorption. Underweight, malnourished celiac sufferers may actually gain weight with wheat removal thanks to improved digestive function. But if we look only at overweight people who are not severely malnourished at the time of diagnosis, who remove wheat from their diet, it becomes clear that this enables them to lose a substantial amount of weight. A Mayo Clinic University of Iowa study of 215 obese celiac patients showed 27.5 pounds of weight loss in the first 6 months of a wheat-free diet. In another study, wheat elimination slashed the number of people classified as obese, body mass index, or BMI, 30 or greater, in half within a year. Oddly, investigators performing these studies usually attribute the weight loss of wheat and gluten-free diets to lack of food variety. Food variety, incidentally, can still be quite wide and wonderful after wheat is eliminated, as I will discuss. Advice to consume more healthy whole grains therefore causes increased consumption of the amylopectin A form of wheat carbohydrate, a form of carbohydrate that, for all practical purposes, is little different and in some ways worse than dipping your spoon into the sugar bowl. Gluten. We hardly know ya. If you were to add water to wheat flour, knead the mixture into dough, then rinse the glob under running water to wash away starches and fiber, you'd be left with a protein mixture called gluten. Wheat is the principal source of gluten in the diet, both because wheat products have come to dominate and because most Americans do not make a habit of consuming plentiful quantities of barley, rye, bulgur, kamut, or triticale, the other sources of gluten. For all practical purposes, therefore, when I discuss gluten, I am primarily referring to wheat. While wheat is, by weight, mostly carbohydrate, as amylopectin A, gluten protein is what makes wheat, wheat. Gluten is the unique component of wheat that makes dough doughy, stretchable, rollable, spreadable, twistable, baking gymnastics that cannot be achieved with rice flour, corn flour, or any other grain. Gluten allows the pizza maker to roll and toss dough and mold it into the characteristic flattened shape. It allows the dough to stretch and rise when yeast fermentation causes it to fill with air pockets. The distinctive doughy quality of the simple mix of wheat flour and water, properties food scientists call viscoelasticity and cohesiveness, are due to gluten. While wheat is mostly carbohydrate and only 10 to 15% protein, 80% of that protein is gluten. Wheat without gluten would lose the unique qualities that transform dough into bagels, pizza, or focaccia. Here's a quick lesson in this thing called gluten, a lesson that you might categorize under know thine enemy. Glutens are the storage proteins of the wheat plant, a means of storing carbon and nitrogen for germination of the seed to form new wheat plants. Leavening, the rising process created by the marriage of wheat with yeast, does not occur without gluten and is therefore unique to wheat flour. The term gluten encompasses two primary families of proteins, the gliadins and the glutenins. The gliadins, the protein group that most vigorously triggers the immune response in celiac disease, has three subtypes, alpha-beta gliadins, gamma-gliadins, and omega-gliadins. Like amylopectin, glutenins are largely repeating structures, or polymers, of more basic structures. The strength of dough is due to the large polymeric glutenins, a genetically programmed characteristic purposefully selected by plant breeders. Gluten from one wheat strain can be quite different in structure from that of another strain. The gluten proteins produced by einkorn wheat, for example, are distinct from the gluten proteins of emmer, which are, in turn, different from the gluten proteins of Triticum aestivum. Because 14-chromosome einkorn, containing the so-called A genome, set of genes, has the smallest chromosomal set, it codes for the fewest number and variety of glutens. 28-chromosome emmer, containing the A genome with the added B genome, codes for a larger variety of gluten. 42-chromosome Triticum aestivum, with the A, B, and D genomes, has the greatest gluten variety, even before any human manipulation of its breeding. Hybridization efforts of the past 50 years have generated numerous additional changes in gluten-coding genes in Triticum aestivum, most of them purposeful modifications of the D genome that confer baking and aesthetic characteristics on flour. Indeed, genes located in the D genome are those most frequently pinpointed as the source of the glutens that trigger celiac disease. It is therefore the D genome of modern Triticum aestivum that, having been the focus of all manner of genetic shenanigans by plant geneticists, has accumulated substantial change in genetically determined characteristics of gluten proteins. It is also, potentially, the source for many of the odd health phenomena experienced by consuming humans. It's not all about gluten. Gluten isn't the only potential villain lurking in wheat flour. Beyond gluten, the other 20% or so of non-gluten proteins in wheat include albumins, prolamins, and globulins, each of which can also vary from strain to strain. In total, there are more than 1,000 other proteins that are meant to serve such functions as protecting the grain from pathogens, providing water resistance, and providing reproductive functions. There are agglutinins, peroxidases, amylases, serpins, and acyl-CoA oxidases, not to mention 5 forms of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenases. I shouldn't neglect to mention beta-pyrethionin, pyroindolins, A and B, and starch synthases. Wheat ain't just gluten, any more than southern cooking is just grits. As if this protein enzyme smorgasbord weren't enough, food manufacturers have also turned to fungal enzymes, such as cellulases, glucoamylases, xylanases, and beta-xylosidases, to enhance leavening and texture in wheat products. Many bakers also add soy flour to their dough to enhance mixing and whiteness, introducing yet another collection of proteins and enzymes. In celiac disease, the one conventionally accepted, though much underdiagnosed, example of wheat-related intestinal illness, gluten protein, specifically alpha-gliadin, provokes an immune response that inflames the small intestine, causing incapacitating abdominal cramps and diarrhea. Treatment is simple: complete avoidance of anything containing gluten. Beyond celiac disease, though, there are allergic and anaphylactic, a severe reaction resulting in shock, reactions to non-gluten proteins, including amylases, thioredoxin, and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, along with about a dozen others. Exposure in susceptible individuals triggers asthma, rashes, atopic dermatitis, and urticaria, and a curious and dangerous condition called wheat-dependent exercise-induced anaphylaxis, WDEIA, in which rash, asthma, or anaphylaxis are provoked during exercise. WDEIA is most commonly associated with wheat. It can also occur with shellfish, and has been attributed to various gliadins and glutenins. In short, wheat is not just a complex carbohydrate with gluten and bran. Wheat is a complex collection of biochemically unique compounds that vary widely according to genetic code. Just by looking at a poppy seed muffin, for instance, you would be unable to discern the incredible variety of gliadins, other gluten proteins, and non-gluten proteins contained within it, many of them unique to the modern dwarf wheat that was your muffin's source. On taking your first bite, you would enjoy the immediate sweetness of the muffin's amylopectin A as it sends your blood sugar skyward. Let's next explore the incredible wide-ranging health effects of your muffin and other wheat-containing foods. Part 2. Wheat and its head-to-toe destruction of health. Chapter 4. Hey man, wanna buy some exorphins? The addictive properties of wheat. Addiction, withdrawal, delusions, hallucinations. I'm not describing mental illness or a scene from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I'm talking about this food you invite into your kitchen, share with friends, and dunk in your coffee. I will discuss why wheat is unique among foods for its curious effects on the brain, effects shared with opiate drugs. It explains why some people experience incredible difficulty removing wheat from their diet. It's not just a matter of inadequate resolve, inconvenience, or breaking well-worn habits. It's about severing a relationship with something that gains hold of your psyche and emotions, not unlike the hold heroin has over the desperate addict. While you knowingly consume coffee and alcohol to obtain specific mind effects, wheat is something you consume for nutrition, not for a fix. Like drinking the Kool-Aid at the Jim Jones revival meeting, you may not even be aware that this thing, endorsed by all official agencies, is fiddling with your mind. People who eliminate wheat from their diet typically report improved mood, fewer mood swings, improved ability to concentrate, and deeper sleep within just days to weeks of their last bite of bagel or baked lasagna. These sorts of soft subjective experiences on our brains, however, are tough to quantify. They are also subject to the placebo effect, that is, people just think they're feeling better. I am, however, impressed with how consistent these observations are, experienced by the majority of people once the initial withdrawal effects of mental fog and fatigue subside. I've personally experienced these effects and also witnessed them in thousands of people. It is easy to underestimate the psychological pull of wheat. Just how dangerous can an innocent bran muffin be, after all? Bread is my crack. Wheat is the Haight-Ashbury of foods, unparalleled for its potential to generate entirely unique effects on the brain and nervous system. There is no doubt, for some people, wheat is addictive, and in some people, it is addictive to the point of obsession. Some people with wheat addiction just know they have a wheat addiction. Or perhaps they identify it as an addiction to some wheat-containing food, such as pasta or pizza. They already understand, even before I tell them, that their wheat food addiction of choice provides a little high. I still get shivers when a well-dressed suburban soccer mom desperately confesses to me, "Bread is my crack. I just can't give it up." Wheat can dictate food choice, calorie consumption, timing of meals and snacks. It can influence behavior and mood. It can even come to dominate thoughts. A number of my patients, when presented with a suggestion of removing it from their diets, report obsessing over wheat products to the point of thinking about them, talking about them, salivating over them constantly for weeks. "I can't stop thinking about bread. I dream about bread," they tell me, leading some to succumb to a wheat-consuming frenzy and give up within days after starting. There is, of course, a flip side to addiction. When people divorce themselves from wheat-containing products, 30% experience something that can only be called withdrawal. I personally witnessed hundreds of people report extreme fatigue, mental fog, irritability, inability to function at work or school, even depression in the first several days to weeks after eliminating wheat. Complete relief is achieved by a bagel or cupcake, or, sadly, more like 4 bagels, 2 cupcakes, a bag of pretzels, 2 muffins, and a handful of brownies, followed the next morning by a nasty case of wheat remorse. It's a vicious circle. Abstain from a substance, and a distinctly unpleasant experience ensues. Resume it, the unpleasant experience ceases. That sounds a lot like addiction and withdrawal to me. People who haven't experienced these effects poo-poo it all, thinking it strains credibility to believe that something as pedestrian as wheat can affect the central nervous system much as nicotine or crack cocaine do. There is a scientifically plausible reason for both the addiction and withdrawal effects. Not only does wheat exert effects on the normal brain, but also on the vulnerable abnormal brain, with results beyond simple addiction and withdrawal. Studying the effects of wheat on the abnormal brain can teach us some lessons on why and how wheat can be associated with such phenomena. Wheat and the schizophrenic mind. The first important lessons on the effects wheat has on the brain came through studying its effects on people with schizophrenia. Schizophrenics lead a difficult life. They struggle to differentiate reality from internal fantasy, often entertaining delusions of persecution, even believing their minds and actions are controlled by external forces. Remember Son of Sam David Berkowitz, the New York City serial killer who stalked his victims on instructions received from his dog? Thankfully, violent behavior is unusual in schizophrenics, but it illustrates the depth of pathology possible. Once schizophrenia is diagnosed, there is little hope of leading a normal life of work, family, and children. A life of institutionalization, medications with awful side effects, and a constant struggle with dark internal demons lies ahead. So what are the effects of wheat on the vulnerable schizophrenic mind? The earliest formal connection of the effects of wheat on the schizophrenic brain began with the work of psychiatrist F. Curtis Doan, whose observations ranged as far as Europe and New Guinea. Dr. Doan journeyed down this line of investigation because he observed that during World War II, the men and women of Finland, Norway, Sweden, Canada, and the United States required fewer hospitalizations for schizophrenia when food shortages made bread unavailable, only to require an increased number of hospitalizations when wheat consumption resumed after the war was over. Dr. Doan observed a similar pattern in the hunter-gatherer Stone Age culture of New Guinea. Prior to the introduction of Western influence, schizophrenia was virtually unknown, diagnosed in only 2 of 65,000 inhabitants. As Western eating habits infiltrated the New Guinean population and cultivated wheat products, beer made from barley, and corn were introduced, Dr. Doan watched the incidence of schizophrenia skyrocket 65-fold. On this background, he set out to develop the observations that established whether or not there was a cause and effect relationship between wheat consumption and schizophrenia. In the mid-60s, while working at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Philadelphia, Dr. Doan and his colleagues decided to remove all wheat products from meals provided to schizophrenic patients without their knowledge or permission. This was in the era before informed consent of participants was required, and before the infamous Tuskegee syphilis experiment became publicized, which triggered public outrage and led to legislation requiring fully informed participant consent. Lo and behold, 4 weeks sans wheat, and there were distinct and measurable improvements in the hallmarks of the disease. A reduced number of auditory hallucinations, fewer delusions, less detachment from reality. Psychiatrists then added the wheat products back into their patients' diets, and the hallucinations, delusions, and social detachment rushed right back. Remove wheat again, patients and symptoms got better. Add it back, they got worse. The Philadelphia observations in schizophrenics were corroborated by psychiatrists at the University of Sheffield in England, with similar conclusions. There have since even been reports of complete remission of the disease, such as the 70-year-old schizophrenic woman described by Duke University doctors suffering with delusions, hallucinations, and suicide attempts with sharp objects and cleaning solutions over a period of 53 years, who experienced complete relief from psychosis and suicidal desires within 8 days of stopping wheat. While it seems unlikely that wheat exposure caused schizophrenia in the first place, the observations of Dr. Doan and others suggest that wheat is associated with measurable worsening of symptoms. Another condition in which wheat may exert effects on a vulnerable mind is autism. Autistic children suffer from impaired ability to interact socially and communicate. The condition has increased in frequency over the past 40 years, from rare in the mid-20th century to 1 in 150 children in the 21st. Initial small samples have demonstrated improvement in autistic behaviors with wheat gluten removal. The most comprehensive clinical trial to date involved 55 autistic Danish children, with formal measures of autistic behavior showing improvement with gluten elimination, along with elimination of casein from dairy. While it remains a topic of debate, a substantial proportion of children and adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, may also respond to elimination of wheat. However, responses are often muddied due to sensitivities to other components of diet, such as sugars, artificial sweeteners, additives, and dairy. It is unlikely that wheat exposure was the initial cause of autism or ADHD, but as with schizophrenia, wheat appears to be associated with worsening of the symptoms characteristic of the conditions. Though the laboratory rat treatment of the unsuspecting schizophrenic patients in the Philadelphia VA hospital may send chills down our spines from the comfort of our fully informed and consenting 21st century, it is nevertheless a graphic illustration of wheat's effect on mental function. But why in the world are schizophrenia, autism, and ADHD exacerbated by wheat? What is in this grain that worsens psychosis and other abnormal behaviors? Investigators at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, set out to find some answers. Exorphins, the wheat-mind connection. Dr. Christine Ziudru and her colleagues at the NIH subjected gluten, the main protein of wheat, to a simulated digestive process to mimic what happens after we eat bread or other wheat-containing products. Exposed to pepsin, a stomach enzyme, and hydrochloric acid, stomach acid, gluten is degraded to a mix of polypeptides. The dominant polypeptides were then isolated and administered to laboratory rats. These polypeptides were discovered to have the peculiar ability to penetrate the blood-brain barrier that separates the bloodstream from the brain. This barrier is there for a reason. The brain is highly sensitive to the wide variety of substances that gain entry to the blood, some of which can provoke undesirable effects should they cross into your amygdala, hippocampus, cerebral cortex, or other brain structure. Once having gained entry into the brain, wheat polypeptides bind to the brain's morphine receptor, the very same receptor to which opiate drugs bind. Ziudru and her colleagues dubbed these polypeptides exorphins, short for exogenous morphine-like compounds, distinguishing them from endorphins, the endogenous, internally sourced morphine-like compounds that occur, for instance, during a runner's high. They named the dominant polypeptide that crossed the blood-brain barrier gluteomorphin, or morphine-like compound from gluten, though the name sounds to me more like a morphine shot in the butt. The investigators speculated that exorphins might be the active factors derived from wheat that account for the deterioration of schizophrenic symptoms seen in the Philadelphia VA hospital and elsewhere. Even more telling, the brain effect of gluten-derived polypeptides is blocked by administration of the drug naloxone. Let's pretend you're an inner-city heroin addict. You get knifed during a drug deal gone sour and get carted to the nearest trauma emergency room. Because you're high on heroin, you kick and scream at the ER staff trying to help you. So these nice people strap you down and inject you with a drug called naloxone, and you are instantly not high. Through the magic of chemistry, naloxone immediately reverses the action of heroin or any other opiate drug, such as morphine or oxycodone. In lab animals, administration of naloxone blocks the binding of wheat exorphins to the morphine receptor of brain cells. Yes, opiate-blocking naloxone prevents the binding of wheat-derived exorphins to the brain. The very same drug that turns off the heroin in a drug-abusing addict also blocks the effects of wheat exorphins. In a World Health Organization study of 32 schizophrenic people with active auditory hallucinations, naloxone was shown to reduce hallucinations. Unfortunately, the next logical step, administering naloxone to schizophrenics, eating a normal wheat-containing diet compared to schizophrenics administered naloxone on a wheat-free diet, has not been studied. Clinical studies that might lead to conclusions that don't support drug use are often not performed. In this case, had naloxone shown benefit in wheat-consuming schizophrenics, the unavoidable conclusion would have been to eliminate wheat, not prescribe the drug. The schizophrenia experience shows us that wheat exorphins have the potential to exert distinct effects on the brain. Those of us without schizophrenia don't experience auditory hallucinations from exorphins resulting from an onion bagel, but these compounds are still there in the brain, no different than in a schizophrenic. It also highlights how wheat is truly unique among grains, since other grains, such as millet and flax, do not generate exorphins, since they lack gluten. Nor do they cultivate obsessive behavior or withdrawal in people with normal brains or people with abnormal brains. So this is your brain on wheat. Digestion yields morphine-like compounds that bind to the brain's opiate receptors. It induces a form of reward, a mild euphoria. When the effect is blocked, or no exorphin-yielding foods are consumed, some people experience a distinctly unpleasant withdrawal. What happens if normal, that is, non-schizophrenic humans, are given opiate-blocking drugs? In a study conducted at the Psychiatric Institute of the University of South Carolina, wheat-consuming participants given naloxone consumed 33% fewer calories at lunch and 23% fewer calories at dinner, a total of approximately 400 calories less over the two meals, than participants given a placebo. At the University of Michigan, binge eaters were confined to a room filled with food for 1 hour. There's an idea for a new TV show, The Biggest Gainer. Participants consumed 28% less wheat crackers, breadsticks, and pretzels with administration of naloxone. In other words, block the euphoric reward of wheat and calorie intake goes down, since wheat no longer generates the favorable feelings that encourage repetitive consumption. Predictably, this strategy is being pursued by the pharmaceutical industry to commercialize a weight loss drug that contains naltrexone, an oral equivalent to naloxone. The drug is purported to block the mesolimbic reward system buried deep within the human brain that is responsible for generating pleasurable feelings from heroin, morphine, and other substances. Pleasurable feelings can be replaced by feelings of dysphoria or unhappiness. Naltrexone will therefore be combined with the antidepressant and smoking cessation drug bupropion. From withdrawal effects to psychotic hallucinations, wheat is party to some peculiar neurological phenomena. To recap, common wheat, upon digestion, yields polypeptides that possess the ability to cross into the brain and bind to opiate receptors. The action of wheat-derived polypeptides, the so-called exorphins such as gluteomorphin, can be short-circuited with the opiate-blocking drugs naloxone and naltrexone. When administered to normal people or people with uncontrollable appetite, opiate-blocking drugs yield reductions in appetite, cravings, and calorie intake, as well as dampen mood, and the effect seems particularly specific to wheat-containing products. Wheat, in fact, nearly stands alone as a food with potent central nervous system effects. Outside of intoxicants such as ethanol, like that in your favorite Merlot or Chardonnay, wheat is one of the few foods that can alter behavior, induce pleasurable effects, and generate a withdrawal syndrome upon its removal. And it required observations in schizophrenic patients to teach us about these effects. Night cravings conquered. For as long as he could remember, Larry struggled with weight. It never made sense to him. He exercised, often to extremes. A 50-mile bike ride was not unusual, nor was a 15-mile walk in the woods or desert. As part of his work, Larry enjoyed the terrain of many different areas of the United States. His travel often took him to the Southwest, where he hiked for up to 6 hours. He also prided himself on following a healthy diet, limiting his red meat and oils, and eating plenty of vegetables and fruit, and, yes, an abundance of healthy whole grains. I met Larry because of a heart rhythm problem, an issue we dealt with easily. But his blood work was another issue. In short, it was a disaster. Blood glucose in the low diabetic range, triglycerides too high at 210 milligrams per deciliter, HDL too low at 37 milligrams per deciliter, and 70% of his LDL particles were the small heart disease-causing type. Blood pressure was an important issue, with systolic, top values, ranging up to 170 millimeters mercury, and diastolic, bottom values, of 90 millimeters mercury. Larry was also at 5 feet 8 inches and 243 pounds, about 80 pounds overweight. "I don't get it. I exercise like nobody you know. I really like exercise, but I just cannot lose the weight, no matter what I do." Larry recounted his diet escapades that included an all-rice diet, protein drink programs, detox regimens, even hypnosis. They all resulted in a few pounds lost, only to be promptly regained. He did admit to one peculiar excess. "I really struggle with my appetite at night. After dinner, I can't resist the urge to graze. I try to graze on the good stuff, like whole wheat pretzels and these multigrain crackers I have with a yogurt dip. But I'll sometimes eat all night from dinner until I go to bed. I don't know why, but something happens at night and I just can't stop." I counseled Larry on the need to remove the number one most powerful appetite stimulant in his diet, wheat. Larry gave me that "not another kooky idea" look. After a big sigh, he agreed to give it a go. With four teenagers in the house, clearing the shelves of all things wheat was quite a task, but he and his wife did it. Larry returned to my office 6 weeks later. He reported that, within 3 days, his nighttime cravings had disappeared entirely. He now ate dinner and was satisfied with no need to graze. He also noticed that his appetite was much smaller during the day, and his desire for snacks virtually disappeared. He also admitted that, now that his craving for food was much less, his calorie intake and portion size was a fraction of its former level. With no change in his exercise habits, he'd lost only 11 pounds. But more than that, he also felt that he'd regained control over appetite and impulse, a feeling he thought he'd lost years earlier. Wheat, appetite stimulant. Crackheads and heroin addicts shooting up in the dark corners of an inner-city drug house have no qualms about ingesting substances that mess with their minds. But how about law-abiding citizens like you and your family? I'll bet your idea of mind-bending is going for the strong brew rather than the mild stuff at Starbucks, or hoisting one too many Heinekens on the weekend. But ingesting wheat means you have been unwittingly ingesting the most common dietary mind-active food known. In effect, wheat is an appetite stimulant. It makes you want more cookies, cupcakes, pretzels, candy, soft drinks, more bagels, muffins, tacos, submarine sandwiches, pizza. It makes you want both wheat-containing and non-wheat-containing foods. And on top of that, for some people, wheat is a drug, or at least yields peculiar drug-like neurological effects that can be reversed with medications used to counter the effects of narcotics. If you balk at the notion of being dosed with a drug such as naloxone, you might ask, what happens if, rather than blocking the brain effect of wheat chemically, you simply remove the wheat altogether? Well, that's the very same question I have been asking. Provided you can tolerate the withdrawal, while unpleasant, the withdrawal syndrome is generally harmless, aside from the rancor you incur from your irritated spouse, friends, and co-workers. Hunger and cravings diminish, calorie intake decreases, mood and well-being increase, weight goes down, wheat belly shrinks. Understanding that wheat, specifically exorphins from gluten, have the potential to generate euphoria, addictive behavior, and appetite stimulation means that we have a potential means of weight control, Lose the wheat, lose the weight. Chapter 5. Your wheat belly is showing. The wheat-obesity connection. Perhaps you've experienced this scenario. You encounter a friend you haven't seen in some time and exclaim with delight, "Elizabeth, when are you due?" Elizabeth, pause. Due? I'm not sure what you mean. You, gulp. Yes, indeed. Wheat belly's abdominal fat can do a darn good imitation of a baby bump. Why does wheat cause fat accumulation specifically in the abdomen and not, say, on the scalp, left ear, or backside? And beyond the occasional I'm not pregnant mishap, why does it matter? And why would elimination of wheat lead to loss of abdominal fat? Let's explore the unique features of the wheat belly habitus. Wheat belly, love handles, man boobs, and food babies. These are the curious manifestations of consuming the modern grain we call wheat. Dimpled or smooth, hairy or hairless, tense or flaccid, wheat bellies come in as many shapes, colors, and sizes as there are humans, but all share the same underlying metabolic cause. I'd like to make the case that foods made with or containing wheat make you fat. I'd go as far as saying that overly enthusiastic wheat consumption is the main cause of the obesity and diabetes crisis in the United States. It's a big part of the reason why Jillian Michaels needs to badger Biggest Loser contestants. It explains why modern athletes, such as baseball players and triathletes, are fatter than ever. Blame wheat when you are being crushed in your airline seat by the 280-pound man next to you. Sure, sugary soft drinks and sedentary lifestyles add to the problem. But for the great majority of health-conscious people who don't indulge in these obvious weight-gaining behaviors, the principal trigger for increasing weight is wheat. In fact, the incredible financial bonanza that the proliferation of wheat in the American diet has created for the food and drug industries can make you wonder if this perfect storm was somehow man-made. Did a group of powerful men convene a secret Howard Hughesian meeting in 1955, map out an evil plan to mass-produce high-yield, low-cost dwarf wheat, engineer the release of government-sanctioned advice to eat healthy whole grains, lead the charge of corporate big food to sell hundreds of billions of dollars worth of processed wheat food products, all leading to obesity and the need for billions of dollars of drug treatments for diabetes, heart disease, and all the other health consequences of obesity? It sounds ridiculous, but in a sense, that's exactly what happened. Here's how. Wheat belly diva. Celeste no longer felt cool. At age 61, Celeste reported that she'd gradually gained weight from her normal range of 120 to 135 pounds in her 20s and 30s. Something happened starting in her mid-40s, and even without substantial changes in habits, she gradually ballooned up to 182 pounds. "This is the heaviest I have ever been," she groaned. As a professor of modern art, Celeste hung around with a fairly urbane crowd, and her weight made her feel even more self-conscious and out of place. So I got an attentive ear when I explained my diet approach that involved elimination of all wheat products. Over the first 3 months, she lost 21 pounds, more than enough to convince her that the program worked. She was already having to reach to the back of her closet to find clothes she hadn't been able to wear for the past 5 years. Celeste stuck to the diet, admitting to me that it had quickly become second nature, with no cravings, a rare need to snack, just a comfortable cruise through meals that kept her satisfied. She noted that from time to time, work pressures kept her from being able to have lunch or dinner, but the prolonged periods without something to eat proved effortless. I reminded her that healthy snacks, such as raw nuts, flaxseed crackers, and cheese, readily fit into her program. But she simply found that snacks weren't necessary most of the time. 14 months after adopting the wheat belly diet, Celeste couldn't stop smiling when she returned to my office at 127 pounds, a weight she'd last seen in her 30s. She'd lost 55 pounds from her high, including 12 inches off her waist, which shrank from 39 inches to 27. Not only could she fit into size 6 dresses again, she no longer felt uncomfortable mingling with the artsy set. No more need to conceal her sagging wheat belly under loose-fitting tops or layers. She could wear her tightest Oscar de la Renta cocktail dress proudly. No wheat belly bulge in sight. Whole grains, half-truths. In nutrition circles, whole grain is the dietary darling du jour. In fact, this USDA-endorsed heart-healthy ingredient, the stuff that purveyors of dietary advice agree you should eat more of, makes us hungry and fat, hungrier and fatter than any other time in human history. Hold up a current picture of 10 random Americans against a picture of 10 Americans from the early 20th century, or any preceding century where photographs are available, and you'd see the stark contrast. Americans are now fat. According to the CDC, 34.4% of adults are now overweight, BMI of 25 to 29.9, and another 33.9% are obese, BMI 30 or greater, leaving less than 1 in 3 normal weight. Since 1960, the ranks of the obese have grown the most rapidly, nearly tripling over those 50 years. Few Americans were overweight or obese during the first two centuries of the nation's history. Most data collected on BMI that we have for comparison prior to the 20th century come from body weight and height tabulated by the U.S. military. The average male in the military in the late 19th century had a BMI of less than 23.2, regardless of age. By the 1990s, the average military BMI was well into the overweight range. We can easily presume that if it applies to military recruits, it's worse in the civilian population. Weight grew at the fastest pace once the USDA and others got into the business of telling Americans what to eat. Accordingly, while obesity grew gradually from 1960, the real upward acceleration of obesity started in the mid-80s. Studies conducted during the 80s and since have shown that when processed white flour products are replaced with whole grain flour products, there is a reduction in colon cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. That is indeed true and indisputable. According to accepted dietary wisdom, if something that is bad for you, white flour, is replaced by something less bad, whole wheat, then lots of that less bad thing must be great for you. By that logic, if high-tar cigarettes are bad for you and low-tar cigarettes are less bad, then lots of low-tar cigarettes should be good for you. An imperfect analogy, perhaps, but it illustrates the flawed rationale used to justify the proliferation of grains in our diet. Throw into the mix the fact that wheat has undergone extensive agricultural genetics-engineered changes, and you have devised the formula for creating a nation of fat people. The USDA and other official opinion makers say that more than two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese because we're inactive and gluttonous. We sit on our fat behinds watching too much reality TV, spend too much time online, and don't exercise. We drink too much sugary soda and eat too much fast food and junk snacks. Betcha can't eat just one. Certainly, these are poor habits that will eventually take their toll on one's health. But I meet plenty of people who tell me that they follow official nutritional guidelines seriously, avoid junk foods and fast foods, exercise an hour every day, all while continuing to gain and gain and gain. Many follow the guidelines set by the USDA food pyramid, 6 to 11 servings of grain per day, of which 4 or more should be whole grain, the American Heart Association, the American Dietetic Association, or the American Diabetes Association. The cornerstone of all these nutritional directives? Eat more healthy whole grains. Are these organizations in cahoots with the wheat farmers and seed and chemical companies? There's more to it than that. Eat more healthy whole grains is really just the corollary of the cut the fat movement embraced by the medical establishment in the 60s, based on epidemiologic observations that suggested that higher dietary fat intakes are associated with higher cholesterol levels and risk for heart disease. Americans were advised to reduce total and saturated fat intake. Grain-based foods came to replace the calorie gap left by reduced fat consumption. The whole grain is better than white argument further fueled the transition. The low-fat, more-grain message also proved enormously profitable for the processed food industry. It triggered an explosion of processed food products, most requiring just a few pennies worth of basic materials. Wheat flour, cornstarch, high-fructose corn syrup, sucrose, and food coloring are now the main ingredients of products that fill the interior aisles of any modern supermarket. Whole ingredients, such as vegetables, meats, and dairy, tend to be at the perimeter of these same stores. Revenues for big food companies swelled. Kraft alone now generates $48.1 billion in annual revenues, an 1,800% increase since the late 80s, a substantial portion of which comes from wheat and corn-based snacks. Just as the tobacco industry created and sustained its market with the addictive property of cigarettes, so does wheat in the diet make for a helpless, hungry consumer. From the perspective of the seller of food products, wheat is a perfect processed food ingredient. The more you eat, the more you want. The situation for the food industry has been made even better by the glowing endorsements provided by the U.S. government, urging Americans to eat more healthy whole grains. Grab my love handles, unique properties of visceral fat. Wheat triggers a cycle of insulin-driven satiety and hunger, paralleled by the ups and downs of euphoria and withdrawal, distortions of neurological function, and addictive effects, all leading to fat deposition. The extremes of blood sugar and insulin are responsible for growth of fat, specifically in the visceral organs. Experienced over and over again, visceral fat accumulates, creating a fat liver, two fat kidneys, a fat pancreas, fat large and small intestines, as well as its familiar surface manifestation, a wheat belly. Even your heart gets fat, but you can't see this through the semi-rigid ribs. So the Michelin tire encircling you or your loved one's waistline represents the surface manifestation of visceral fat contained within the abdomen and encasing abdominal organs, resulting from months to years of repeated cycles of high blood sugar and high blood insulin, followed by insulin-driven fat deposition. Not fat deposition in the arms, buttocks, or thighs, but the saggy ridge encircling the abdomen created by bulging fatty internal organs. Exactly why disordered glucose-insulin metabolism preferentially causes visceral fat accumulation in the abdomen and not your left shoulder or the top of your head is a question that continues to stump medical science. Buttock or thigh fat is precisely that. Buttock or thigh fat. No more, no less. You sit on it. You squeeze it into your jeans. You lament the cellulite dimples it creates. It represents excess calories over caloric expenditure. While wheat consumption adds to buttock and thigh fat, the fat in these regions is comparatively quiescent, metabolically speaking. Visceral fat is different. While it might be useful as love handles grasped by your partner, it is also uniquely capable of triggering a universe of inflammatory phenomena. Visceral fat filling and encircling the abdomen of the wheat belly sort is a unique 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week metabolic factory. And what it produces is inflammatory signals and abnormal cytokines, or cell-to-cell hormone signal molecules, such as leptin, resistin, and tumor necrosis factor. The more visceral fat present, the greater the quantities of abnormal signals released into the bloodstream. All body fat is capable of producing another cytokine, adiponectin, a protective molecule that reduces risk for heart disease, diabetes, and hypertension. However, as visceral fat increases, its capacity to produce protective adiponectin diminishes, for reasons unclear. The combination of lack of adiponectin along with increased leptin, tumor necrosis factor, and other inflammatory products underlies abnormal insulin responses, diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease. The list of other health conditions triggered by visceral fat is growing and now includes dementia, rheumatoid arthritis, and colon cancer. This is why waist circumference is proving to be a powerful predictor of all these conditions, as well as of mortality. Visceral fat not only produces abnormally high levels of inflammatory signals, but is also itself inflamed, containing bountiful collections of inflammatory white blood cells, macrophages. The endocrine and inflammatory molecules produced by visceral fat empty via the portal circulation draining blood from the intestinal tract directly into the liver, which then responds by producing yet another sequence of inflammatory signals and abnormal proteins. In other words, in the human body, all fat is not equal. Wheat belly fat is a special fat. It is not just a passive repository for excess pizza calories. It is, in effect, an endocrine gland, much like your thyroid gland or pancreas, albeit a very large and active endocrine gland. Ironically, Grandma was correct 40 years ago when she labeled an overweight person as having a gland problem. Unlike other endocrine glands, the visceral fat endocrine gland does not play by the rules, but follows a unique playbook that works against the body's health. So a wheat belly is not just unsightly, it's also dreadfully unhealthy. Getting high on insulin. Why is wheat so much worse for weight than other foods? The essential phenomenon that sets the growth of the wheat belly in motion is high blood sugar,